Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio program from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Laura Kabalka in Berlin. This week on the show, Spain's radically different approach to migration.
For us, migration is not a source of fear and threat, but a hope, an opportunity.
Then, how Norway is taking the fun out of gambling.
There is an inherent discussion on how much regulation should the state have and how much liberty should its citizens have.
As well as a rare glimpse into a prison in Italy where they're trying to improve conditions for inmates. That's all coming up on Inside Europe. We're starting with a topic that rarely seems to disappear from the headlines: migration. Across Europe, governments are cracking down on migration amid a surge in support of right-wing parties. The EU has just agreed to penalize developing countries that refuse to accept their rejected asylum seekers. But it's not only conservative parties pushing for harsher policies. Denmark has long stood out for its hardline stance, even when it's led by the Social Democrats. One European country, however, is swimming against this increasingly strong current: Spain. And yes, Spain also has an anti-immigration party that is gaining support. But Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez's left-wing coalition government is making it easier for undocumented migrants to work. Sánchez argues it'll help Spain's economy grow. Ashish Sharma reports from Madrid.
Over the next 3 years until 2027, Spain wants to speed up the process of giving up to 300,000 undocumented migrants per year the papers needed to work legally. At a recent political forum at Columbia University, Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez laid out his country's case for welcoming migrants.
Over the past 7 years, our country has received over 2 million immigrants. Migrants have integrated well in our country and contributed around 20% of Spain's per capita economic growth in the last 3 years. For us, migration is not a source of fear and threat, but a hope, an opportunity. Every migrant, legal or illegal, is a human being in search of a better life.
The Spanish economy is one of the fastest growing in Europe, even though its population has one of the slowest birth rates on the continent. At the same time, Spain also has one of the highest unemployment rates in Europe, particularly among young people.
This is due to a number of reasons. One being that, obviously, young Spanish people are more and more highly educated.
Christophe Dumont is the head of the Migration Division at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, which advises countries on policies around economic growth.
It's not necessarily where the labor shortages are the most acute. This is in agriculture, this is in construction, this is in hotels and restaurants. These are mostly low-skilled occupation with low pay. Young, tertiary-educated Spanish people, they are looking for other opportunities. Because of a structure of the economic growth in Spain, which is driven in part by some traditional sector like agriculture, but also tourism, it's not so surprising to see that immigration can play this role despite quite high level of unemployment still.
The largest share of Spain's foreign-born residents come from Latin America. The common language, culture, as well as family ties make Spain an obvious choice for many. I took a taxi to the airport recently. My driver, who comes from Ecuador, has lived in Spain for over 20 years. He told me for many Latin Americans, getting tourist visas is very easy. Others come to study. In most cases, their final aim is to find work. Sanchez's changes to the immigration law came into force in May this year. Key is reducing the time for undocumented migrants to regularize from 3 to 2 years. But that is still too long, as Serena Squizzato from the NGO Red Incola says.
The problem is that they need to wait a lot of time before getting the papers that permit them to work. They have to wait 2 years. It's a long time, so even if they are skilled and they have some degrees, they must wait.
Just a clearing of the work permits can take months, and language is another issue. Khalid Gardamel is from Morocco. He arrived in Spain with his family over 6 months ago on a visitor visa. He came because one of his children needs medical treatment, which is more accessible here. Khalid, who is highly qualified, is hoping he can use his skill set and experience in finance to find work in Spain.
For this time, I don't have work. It was in bank, director of finance in bank in Marruecos. I study economica in Marruecos. I'm learning very hard Spanish. For a job, the finance or work with a company here.
So your problem is not one of qualifications or experience, it's actually one of language.
I have a difficulty to find work because I don't speak very, very well Spanish. I learn very hard, more than 8 hours.
Every day?
Every day. It's necessary.
Khalid is a proud man and didn't want to tell me on tape, but did give me permission to say that he also occasionally receives food parcels from Red Inkler to help him with his family. The NGO also supports migrants by offering free Spanish classes, legal aid, and exploring work opportunities to help them survive.
Also, I work with people that have papers, and the problem in that case was the origin sometimes, because you know that there is some kind of racism here, because if your name is too long or it there's some strange letters, you can't work in some places.
The far-right Vox Party says that Sanchez's policies will encourage more irregular migration and dilute Spain's Christian heritage. The conservative Partido Popular, the PP, also wants to restrict regularization and harden immigration laws. Javier Zarzalejos is an MEP for the Partido Popular.
Once you are a legal resident in a European country, you can move around the European Union freely. So other countries can say, well, that has to be taken more cautiously. So first of all, it should be exceptional. Second, there should be a clear link between a reasonable period of work and presence in Spain. There should be also a link between that and a job.
While it's been a fight for the government, for now the new regulation is in place. The hope is that by easing bureaucracy to enable migrants access to work legally and reducing the waiting time from 3 years to 2 will not only help improve their status, but also provide the labour resources the government needs to feed its economic growth. But with both Vox and the PP gaining support, and the next general election due by August 2027, Spain's direction on migration could change again before the government's targets on working migrants are reached. Ashish Sharma, DW, Madrid.
While Spain is shaking up Europe's approach to migration, Norway is doing the same with gambling. By 2028, global gambling losses are estimated to reach more than $700 billion. Online gambling is particularly addictive. That's why Norway is trying to make the gambling experience, well, less exciting. But could their model also work elsewhere? Here's Karen Brown's report for our partners at GBH The World.
A gambling arcade in Oslo, Norway couldn't be further in mood from, say, a traditional resort casino in the U.S. Here's what it sounds like at MGM Casino in Springfield, Massachusetts. And here's what it sounds like at a Norwegian betting place on the second floor of an urban strip mall. People sit in faux leather chairs in front of silent computer terminals.
I have to enter my phone number and birth date.
Bjorn Helga Hoffman logs into his national gambling account to play blackjack on one of the machines. He starts out betting 2 kroner, roughly 20 cents.
I could increase it to 5 kroner per spin.
Hoffman works for the state-owned gambling company Norsk Tipping. And like all Norwegian residents, he's only allowed to lose a certain amount per month, about $2,000. On the first game, he waits for the quiet spinning to stop on the screen.
So does that mean you won or you didn't
win? Yeah, I did win.
You did?
Yeah, on one hand, not the other.
Okay.
You can barely tell. There are no bells, no manufactured sounds of coins falling into a steel bowl.
All those sounds are meant to make you play more, if you see.
So it's hard to get excited by the win, and that's the point. Norway's gambling monopoly is based on reducing gambling impulses. There are no casinos, just slot machines, bingo, lotteries, and horse racing. And the government not only limits how much time and money people can spend, it also limits the style and pace of games to make them less addictive. Charlie Thompson is a Norwegian gambling researcher.
There is an inherent discussion on how much regulation should the state have and how much liberty should its citizens have?
This question has been dogging policy leaders around the world as online gambling expands rapidly. In the U.S., almost 40 states now allow online sports betting. And while some praise Massachusetts for paying attention to problem gambling, compared to Norway, it's practically the Wild West.
First of all, you have to play identified.
The Norwegian government tracks each person's gambling habits as part of the country's harm reduction approach. Hoffman says everyone has to set limits before they even start to play.
How much can you afford to lose in the cold light of the day?
Jani Engebo is a policy advisor for the Norwegian Gambling Authority. He compares Norway's regulations to airbags in cars.
So if it gets really bad, you will not have so severe consequences that you cannot carry on with your life.
Engebo's research suggests the rate of gambling addiction in Norway is less than 1% of the population. It's about three times as high in the U.S. But 25 years ago, Norway had a problem. Slot machines were all over the place, supermarkets, airport lounges, ferries, and there were no spending limits. Magnus Pedersen is with the advocacy group Gambling Addiction Norway. He says people didn't understand how addictive gambling could be. He says it's like going into a bubble.
It's just you and the gambling. Every stress, everything, every problem you have, everything else just goes away. But after a while, it's not enough with $100 or $200. You need $1,000 or you need more.
Pedersen's group helped convince the government to remove all privately owned slot machines and, in 2007, replace them with slower, less addictive machines in fewer locations. And when online gambling arrived, Norway added more limits on time and money. It banned VIP loyalty programs and betting bonuses. Plus, gambling profits all go to charity, not private industry. At Oslo's central train station, one convenience store offers betting machines, and it still gets a steady stream of repeat customers. But manager Fredrik Heidelberg says he doesn't have to worry about them spending all their money.
The system mostly takes care of that for us, because there's a limit to how much you can spend.
And while researcher Charlie Thompson says some people may want more freedom,
in general, Norwegians are much more tolerant towards these invasive policy tools.
In contrast, the Massachusetts Gaming Commission has put in measures that allow players to set time and spending limits. But Mark Vanderlinden, who oversees the state's Responsible Gaming Office, doesn't think U.S. regulators or players would tolerate mandatory limits like Norway has.
The commission is monitoring what's happening in other countries, but you know, there's been a lot that had been tried. Sometimes it can work really well in a country, one country, and fall flat in another country.
But even Norway has seen some pushback. At one Oslo sports pub, bartender Nemo Gasparim was checking scores on his phone. He says he's an avid online gambler, especially on U.S. hockey games.
To be honest, the Norwegian rules are a bit silly.
Gasparim says he prefers better odds and fewer limits, so he goes on foreign gambling websites that are illegal in Norway.
I know that it's not healthy, you know, but I do it because I think it's fun.
Yeah,
I will never stop.
This is an addict.
Norwegian regulators say they are trying to shut down the black market through banking bans and internet blocking. Bjorn Hoffman says they are also trying to make the legal games more exciting.
It doesn't help if you have the best responsible gaming framework or measures in the world if no one wants to play with you.
For The World, I'm Karen Brown.
GBH, The World is available wherever you get your podcasts. This following story requires a trigger warning. Italy has had such poor prison conditions, it's been repeatedly reprimanded by the EU's Court of Human Rights and the Torture Committee. Last year, the reported number of inmate suicides reached an all-time high. Now, the government has finally decided to do something about it. Over the next 2 years, they plan to make space for an additional 15,000 inmates. Angelo van Schaik traveled to Naples to visit the prison of Secondigliano and see the situation for himself.
Bella parte facile. Cognome van Schaik. Verona ancora Napoli. Verona.
Spelling my last name has always been a problem in Italy, but I got used to it. Verona ancora Napoli. In Italy you spell with names of cities. Salerno Como, Hotel Ancona Imola K.
Bisogna la chiave?
No. Deve venire con me in radio olandese.
The Pasquale Mandato prison in Secondigliano, a suburb in the northern part of Naples, is one of the largest prisons in Italy, covering an area of 40 hectares. Around 80% of the inmates are held under a strict prison regime, most of them because they were involved in organized crime. The prison administration is doing its utmost to keep the inmates engaged. They can study at the University of Naples, and there are workshops on offer too. This is a sewing workshop, churning out an eclectic range of products, ranging from judicial robes and vestments for priests and bishops to backpacks for prison guards.
No, questo è un lavoro. Contemporaneamente faccio anche un corso.
Ok, e quanto ore al giorno lo fai?
Lavoro 6 ore al giorno.
This is not a course. This is my daily work, says this inmate. He works 6 hours a day and earns around 800 euros per month.
Ma questo sembra quasi un carcere modello.
Si lavora molto per mantenere dei livelli secondo anche le la visione che ha la nostra direttrice.
We do our best to make it an ideal prison, says Gabriella, a staff member at the Secondigliano prison. In line with our director's policy, we focus on education. We teach the inmates a trade, also with an eye to the future. The goal is to give them more opportunities once they're released. And it works, because the recidivism rate has gone down.
Qual è il tuo sogno quando esci? Allora, il mio sogno è soprattutto quello di diventare un padre di famiglia.
My dream is to become a father when I get out of here. My girlfriend wants that too, says Antonio, who has already spent 8 of his 38 years behind bars. And I want to become a better person. I've made mistakes in the past, but I think I'm on the right path now. I'm taking courses, I'm working, and I've seen guys who used to attend these classes and now have their own businesses outside, doing their work with real passion. I hope that's possible for me too. What strikes me is the peace in this prison. I've been to 2 other prisons in Italy, but I did not experience this kind of peace here. Admittedly, I wasn't able to visit the cells, but based on the areas I was allowed to visit, Secondigliano feels like a model institution.
Lei da quanto tempo sta? 19
mesi.
19 mesi?
19 mesi.
Da poco?
Sì, da poco. Ex avvocato.
Ah.
Tradizione familiare da, diciamo, distrutta, ma...
This former lawyer has been in Secondigliano for 19 months now. Before he came here, he was in Poggioreale, Naples' other prison. But the circumstances were horrible over there, he says. In Poggioreale, he stayed with 7-8 people in a cell. Here, it's only 2. 2 months here is like being 20 months over there, he says.
Diciamo che il carcere problematico di Napoli è Poggioreale.
Secondigliano is a relatively modern prison, says Alessio Scandura of Antigone, a foundation that advocates the rights of inmates in Italy. It is still a large facility with an overcrowding rate of nearly 130% of its capacity. But that's nothing compared to the Poggioreale prison, where the existing prison population is regularly swelled by inmates held on pre-trial detention. In general, the situation in Italian prisons is not good. The country has been repeatedly reprimanded by the European Court for the poor conditions in its prisons. Overcrowded cells, severe maintenance backlogs, and a high number of suicides. But that's not the only problem, says Alessio Scandura from Antigone.
A differenza di qualche anno fa, oggi un detenuto in Italia di norma passa in cella 20 ore al giorno.
An Italian inmate spends an average of 20 hours a day locked in their cell, says Scandura, except for those who work or study, but they make up only a quarter of the prison population. Until a few years ago, cell doors used to stay open and prisoners could walk around. That's no longer the case. We see the consequences of that change every day. There are frequent riots, many inmates self-harm, and suicides are more common than ever. And it's strange, because the prison system that now struggles to house 62,000 inmates used to accommodate far more in the past, without too many problems. So yes, overcrowding is a problem, but it's not the only one. As an extra form of support, the prison of Secondigliano recently started a collaboration with Kimbo, a coffee roasting company located next to the prison. Inmates are learning how to roast coffee and are taking courses to become baristas. At least, that's the aim.
Ho fatto tanti corsi. Tra corsi e corsi ho preso anche il diploma, mi mancavano 2 anni.
I've taken a lot of courses in here, says Felice, who has been incarcerated for over 10 years. I got my high school diploma and I did that course with Kimbo. But the real problem is finding work afterwards. There's already a lack of jobs here in Naples, and for former inmates, it's even more difficult. I've also done job interviews. Companies come here into the prison, and you sit down with them. But the answer is always the same. We'll let you know. I'm not worried for myself. I'm 56 years old. But for the younger guys who are getting out, there's not much out there. The temptation to fall back into crime is very strong. The Italian government seems serious about its desire to tackle prison overcrowding. More prisons, alternative punishment for certain inmates, and early release of others. But according to Antigone, the foundation that monitors Italian incarceration, it's not enough. In their latest report, released at the end of August, they state that the new decree will have little or no impact on the circumstances in Italian prisons, at least for the next few years. In the meantime, 55 inmates have killed themselves this year already. Angelo von Schaik, DW, Secondigliano, Naples, Italy.
Just a quick reminder here that our feedback address is insideeurope@dw.com. You're listening to Inside Europe. I'm Laura Kabelke in Berlin. Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio program from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Laura Kabelke in Berlin. Coming up in the next half hour, a close look at the shocking murder of Hakan Tuzun, the Turkish journalist and environmental defender who died in October. Then, Armenia teams up with NVIDIA, bringing a $500 million AI factory to the small country in the South Caucasus. And finally, the first in our new segment, Age is Just a Number, where you'll hear from young European leaders like Lefteris Arapakis, who's on a mission to clean up the Mediterranean Sea and beyond. That's all coming up on Inside Europe. We begin in Turkey, where the brutal murder of journalist Hakan Tosun has reignited concerns about the country's justice system and the growing threats faced by those trying to protect the environment. Reporter Ilenia Gostuli has been looking into the case.
On a grey afternoon in Istanbul, the funeral of murdered journalist Hakan Tosun feels less like a goodbye and more like a protest. Hundreds turned up. Many of them only knew Hakan as the journalist who would spend days, even weeks or years, documenting their fights to protect the environment. Sometimes, friends say, with barely 100 lira in his pocket. Now it was their turn to show up for him after he was beaten to death on a street in Istanbul back in October. Forests and rivers are crying for Hakan, says one of the chants as mourners call for justice. The words "What happened to Hakan Tosun" are printed on a black and white banner at the front of the funeral procession, headed towards the Cemevi in northwest Istanbul, a house of worship for Alevis, a religious minority Hakan belonged to. One of the people carrying that banner is Alperjan Kilic, one of his friends.
We don't know what actually happened, but he was a very important person. He's going everywhere in Turkey where there's a demonstration or there's a, something wrong about the rights. He always doing the right thing, show everything to humanity and the government and the people. Because of that, he always he can have lots of enemies.
Weeks after his death, Hakan's family, friends and supporters are still looking for answers. On the night of October 10th, Hakan Tosun was beaten on a street in Esenyurt, one of Istanbul's most chaotic districts, a place of rapid development, high rises and increasing gang crime. He was found unconscious. Two men, just 18 and 24, were arrested. Security footage shows them attacking him twice, striking his head again and again as he lay on the ground. 2 days later, he died in hospital of a brain hemorrhage. The unanswered questions are many. Critical camera footage was never collected. Some recordings were retrieved not by police, but reportedly by relatives of the suspects. And the video that could have shown the clearest view from a shop right next to where the attack happened never reached investigators. Lawyer Onur Çingil says these gaps, along with the fact that a third person seen riding a motorcycle at the scene was never taken into custody, cast a long shadow over the investigation.
There should have been 3 arrests, not 2. We formally requested it. But the prosecutor's office refuses to issue the order. Of course, this undermines the integrity of the investigation. Witnesses may be threatened or blackmailed. Some camera footage was never recovered.
Hakan's family didn't find out he'd been hospitalized until 27 hours after the attack, long after his relatives had filed a missing person report. He'd been brought in with no identification. During those crucial hours, an online campaign had already started under the hashtag Where is Hakan Tosun? His sister Osnur believes that without that public pressure, the outcome could have been very different.
The first question we asked was, where is Hakan Tosun? We learned where he was with the support of his friends. If Hakan Tosun hadn't been loved so much, he would have disappeared in the hospital, and we wouldn't have been able to find him. Maybe we wouldn't have been able to find the perpetrators either.
Turkish police say they have assigned 2 inspectors to investigate. The Interior Ministry has not responded to a request for comment on the concerns surrounding the investigation. Activists and press freedom groups are now asking, was this random violence or was Hakan Tosun targeted for who he was? And are the young men who were arrested really the ones behind the killing? Özgür Öret from the Committee to Protect Journalists is among those calling for a full investigation.
Hopefully, this murder will be investigated by every suspicion and different angle considered. And if there are instigators behind this attack, they should also be brought out to light, brought to justice, for full justice to be achieved.
Since the Gezi Park protests, which started as a small effort to save a city park in Istanbul, environmental activists in Turkey have been under growing pressure. Protests are criminalized and local communities fighting projects backed by powerful political or business interests have fewer and fewer ways to challenge them, whether in court or on the streets. Just this November, the government introduced a new rule that gives the presidency the final say on mining permits, another blow to independent oversight of major extraction projects. Many attacks against environmental defenders like Hakan Tosun follow a troubling pattern. A violent death, questions raised, but justice never fully achieved. Back in 2018, in the Mediterranean province of Antalya, activists Ali and Azin Buyuknoucu were murdered after helping shut down marble quarries. The man who killed them later died by suicide in prison, but the quarry owners accused of ordering the attack were never prosecuted. Hakan Tosun's friend Ismail Akildiz, also a longtime activist, remembers traveling with him to that funeral.
Hakan used to participate in these events. Especially after the murder of the couple, we all felt we were being targeted. I think Hakan was one of those who thought this way.
Since Hakan's death, his sister Oznur has been speaking out everywhere she can. Environmental groups hold vigils and screenings of his documentaries to keep his name from fading and to keep pressure on the authorities, because without that pressure, many, including lawyer Onur Çingil, believe nothing will happen.
We will continue to ask these questions. As much as this is a documentation issue, as much as this is an activist issue, this is also about the right to live safely in Istanbul and in Turkey. There are other files like this. I say the same thing about all of them. As long as the Ministry of Justice does not press on these issues, we have come to a point where justice is sought in the press statements, in the statements in front of the courthouse, not in the courts.
Irene Agostoli, DW, Istanbul.
We also wanted you to hear from Hakan Tosun himself. So we're sharing a message from Hakan recorded by his friend, video journalist Kasım Kızıl. It was recorded back in 2023 when Hakan joined a resistance movement against the destruction of Akbelin Forest in Turkey's southwest. Since 2019, villagers had been fighting plans to cut the forest down to make way for a brown coal mine. Here's what Hakan had on his mind back then.
Hakan Tosun, 15 yıldır ekoloji mücadelelerini takip ediyorum ve bunlarla ilgili videolar yapıyorum.
I've been following ecological struggles for 15 years and I've been making videos about them. There are so many. The destruction is everywhere. When I think about it within my own field, I feel like I can't keep up and I get tired. And of course, when you don't achieve any wins, you experience discouragement, a loss of morale. There have been so many attacks in these past 10 to 15 years. We've gone through such harsh times that sometimes I think I need to be ruthless. I tell myself, just film and do your job. Don't identify yourself so much with what's happening. You're a journalist. Act with a journalist's reflex. Make your report Be objective, do your story, then step aside and go live whatever life you're supposed to live. But I think this situation has seeped into me. I wanted to do something for this country, and I did that with my camera. To be honest, it wasn't purely a journalistic reflex. I felt like I was somewhere else. When they came at dawn in a raid, and the next day I saw that the trees had been cut, I felt like I was in a different place. I could see the sky, but what the sky made me feel was emptiness. People usually long to see the sky. In the city, the buildings block it, and you can't see it, so the sky becomes something people miss. But here, after the trees were cut, seeing the sky gave me a bad feeling, an emptiness. I've witnessed many cases of destruction, of cutting, but here I felt the deepest level of internalization. I saw what it means to mourn nature. I better understood how the people living here empathize with this place. I saw what they felt after the trees were cut, when I saw their resin on the stumps. It looked like blood to me. I touched it. It was sticky. And right at the spot where they had been cut, it showed how alive the trees actually were. When I cut open what seemed like a dry piece of wood, I saw life emerging from inside it.
These were Hakan Tosun's words. He was killed at age 50. For our next story, we're traveling to Turkey's eastern neighbor. As the world's largest companies are pouring billions into AI, they are also setting up supercomputing data centers to develop it further and further. One of the latest projects from chipmaking titan NVIDIA is set to bring a $500 million US dollar AI factory to Armenia. NVIDIA is betting big on the small country, which has been undergoing a tech boom in spite of regional turmoil. Shan Charigian has the story.
Hankavan is about an hour's drive from Armenia's capital, Yerevan, and is known for its campgrounds. Every summer, students come here for all kinds of programs. This week, more than 100 are here for something new, learning about career paths in AI. A nonprofit called the Foundation for Armenian Science and Technology organized the camp as part of their efforts to get young Armenians ready for tech jobs. On the last day of the camp, Armenian tech pros sit in circles with high school students from all over Armenia to share advice. One of the day's speakers, a researcher and software engineer named Tigran Ishkhanyan, says a new AI data center will be a boon for the country and for young people like here at the camp.
NVIDIA AI factory will be a game changer for sure, because they will need a lot of professionals. And of course, first of all, they will try to hire someone from Armenia.
As expensive AI factories get built in rich countries, mostly the US, the EU, and China, there's growing concern that countries with fewer resources will be left behind. But Armenia's business and education sectors are now poised to get a big boost thanks to NVIDIA's recently announced plans. NVIDIA, currently the most valuable company on Wall Street, says it is working with a small U.S.-based firm and Armenia's government to set up a supercomputing data center with thousands of chips known as graphics processing units, or GPUs. The launch date is set for 2026, though the specific location of the center is yet to be announced. For now, Armenia is set to be the only country in the region to boast an AI factory. The members of the public-private partnership have been keeping a low profile since they announced their plans over the summer. But it was big news for Armenia, which has about 3 million residents and is still reeling from its recent wars with neighboring Azerbaijan.
We're planting a seed by giving to Armenia an unfair advantage in against all of the other countries. What we're building with this supercomputer isn't just another business. This is going to be a generator for basic research that will then turn into companies that will grow and become a big part of the economy and turn Armenia into a significant player in technology on the global stage.
That's Rev Lebaredian, an NVIDIA executive speaking on a local podcast in June. He explains how AI factories like the one planned for Armenia actually work.
Data information comes in. What comes out of it are what we call tokens, which is a form of intelligence. So we're taking as input raw data and information, and we get intelligence out of it in the form of these tokens. And the more tokens you can produce for the same amount of energy and information, the more efficient you are, the more value you create.
In other words, the factory takes in tons of data, rapidly crunches it using high-powered microchips, and puts out tokens containing condensed info for the AI to learn and respond quickly. AI chips are notorious for consuming huge amounts of electricity and requiring lots of water to stay cool. The new factory from NVIDIA will tap surplus electrical supply in Armenia, which has a nuclear power plant, to run its Blackwell GPU chips, according to Le Baredian. He himself is based in the San Francisco Bay Area, so is the head of Firebird, one of NVIDIA's key partners on the AI factory. People here in Armenia credit members of the widespread Armenian diaspora with helping to create the country's tech sector in recent years. Experts say another factor behind Armenia's tech boom is simple necessity. The country is a bit smaller than Belgium and has few natural resources, so more and more investors and educators are turning to tech. There are some 1,200 tech companies in Armenia today, and they had more than $2 billion in turnover last year, according to a recent study by local nonprofits. The figures cover a mix of homegrown businesses and local outposts to foreign firms, some of which reportedly moved here from Russia to get around Western sanctions.
Okay, so welcome to Tumo Center for Creative Technologies. My name is Sylvie. I'm from Tumo Communications team.
Some of the future workers at NVIDIA's AI factory seem likely to come out of the after-school programs at Armenia's Tumo Center for Creative Technologies. It has taught tech skills and other lessons to thousands of 12 to 18-year-olds for over a decade. In one classroom at Tumo's huge Yerevan building, 12-year-old Robert is learning about robotics. Dozens of other students are spread out and either doing self-study at clusters of computers or learning from instructors in classrooms. Pegor Papazian, Tumo's chief development officer, says he and other tech leaders in Armenia have been involved in conversations about bringing the AI factory to the country.
We were invited by the Firebird team to pitch a couple of ideas on how we would use free computing, if it was available to us, for educational and academic research purposes. It looks like we will be able to benefit directly.
Tumo has proposed projects including a study of student behavior data in order to personalize learning paths and a study focusing on Armenian architecture, according to Papazian. Back at the Honkavon camp, the talks on AI careers last into the evening. Victoria Melkonian, a 16-year-old who's studying IT, voices high hopes for the new factory.
It is very surprising that they had invested like such kind of big money to build servers. And I think this investment from NVIDIA to Armenia will be a great opportunity for these people to show the world that Armenia is not falling behind, but we are catching up and we are also pushing others to go further.
I'm Shant Sharagyan for DW in Armenia.
And now it's time for a little Spotify quiz. Did you know that the average age of people in the European Union is almost 45 years old? Yes, we're clearly headed towards a pension crisis, but that's not what this quiz is about. I want to know which European member state has the youngest population. Is it Bulgaria, Lithuania, Ireland or Malta? Head on over to Spotify to vote, before Googling, of course. I can already tell you that Italy is the country with the oldest population in the EU. And finally, I'm really excited to introduce you to the first character in our new Age is Just a Number mini-series. O Over the next few weeks, you'll hear from youth parliamentarians, disability advocates, environmental defenders, and champions of healthcare equity. I met these inspiring young leaders during this year's One Young World Summit in Munich. They told me about their projects and what motivates them. We're starting with Lefteris Arapakis. He's the founder of Enalia, a nonprofit that tackles marine plastic pollution. He told me it all started in his native Greece, where a soda can changed his life.
My family are fishermen for five generations. So one day around 2016, it was the period that Greece had the capital controls, which means that our banks had collapsed. Unemployment had skyrocketed to 29%. And I was finishing the university and wanted to do something to fight unemployment. I was discussing with my father, and he was complaining to me that they could not find enough people for the fishing boats. So I said that to a friend, and we started the first school for fishing in Greece. On our first trip, it was in the Greek islands of Cyclades, I was really surprised to see that the fishermen were collecting not only fish, but also plastic. In the first catch, I got like a soda drink out of the nets, and its expiry date read 1987. It was older than me. And then the fisherman took it from my hand and threw it back to the water. And he told me, plastic is not our problem. Over the next few days, we collected like so much plastic, literally hundreds of plastic bottles, plastic bags, fishing nets, a refrigerator, a washing machine. And the fishermen were just throwing them back every time. I became shocked about that, and I started reading. And all the papers said that by 2050, there will be more plastic than fish in the sea. And I saw that. And we realized that it doesn't make any sense to create more fishermen out there if we don't do something about plastic. So this is what we did. I used a theory called the tipping point. If you want to achieve a social movement or a social change, you need to convince at least 18% of the population to change. So we were, for example, in this fishing port with 40 fishermen. So I just wanted to convince 8 of them to join the program. My father helped me with identifying to which fishermen I should talk first. You know, local leaders, or maybe sometimes he's the best fisherman in town or the oldest fisherman in the town. So we built trust with them and they appreciated that. In that port, we got 8 fishermen the first week. And then a couple of months later, we had 38 out of 40 fishermen. Then these 38 people, they started, you know, convincing other fishing communities. And this is how the project expanded. And they started bringing back like vast amounts of plastic. You know, plastic bottles were 3% of the plastic we collected. Plastic straws, 0.0002%. The most common plastic we find in the Mediterranean is old fishing gear, ghost nets. So it gets fish, turtles, dolphins, seals, traps them, kills them, and turns them into skeletons. Imagine our surprise when we're pulling out of the sea nets that were hundreds of meters long, full of skeletons. So we also trained them to hand over their old fishing gear to prevent it from becoming ghost gear. And then as we started collecting more plastic, we had another challenge. We had no idea what to do with that. The local municipalities were sending the plastic to landfill, and that was the good case scenario. So gradually we created partnerships with recycling companies. So in each port and in each island we're operating, we put a container, and then the fishermen were putting the plastic inside the container. The plastic was getting sorted, washed, shredded, and turned into pellets. Pellets from fishing nets were turned into tables, benches, building materials. So we replicated our model to Italy, and then Croatia, and then Spain, and then Egypt. For example, in Italy, it was illegal until recently to collect plastic from the sea. So there is a new law that has passed now, the Salva Mare law, with a lot of organizations like WWF pushing to pass this law. Now it is legal to collect plastic from the sea. But imagine, you know, you go there, you try to do that, and they tell you it is illegal. So in Italy, we focused on the prevention activities. And now we are working with more than 6,000 fishermen in all of these countries, 74 locations. We have collected until now more than 2 million kilograms of plastic from the Mediterranean Sea, and we have prevented around 1 million kilograms of carbon dioxide emissions. Based on these numbers, we are probably the largest plastic cleanup initiative in the Mediterranean. But it is just 20% of the plastic that Greece dropped into the sea last year. So we are hybrid. We have a non-profit component that has to do with awareness raising, the trainings and the cleanups. And we have a for-profit component that has to do with the technology and the circular economy. So the reason we have structured it like that is we have seen that grants and donations are very volatile. But let me tell you, if you have a project for 6 months or 12 months with the fishing community, then you tell them, hey guys, the funding stopped, this fishing community will never, ever work together with you again. So we try to diversify our income so we can do more impact. Full-time in the team now, we are 12 people, and we have another 30 people working on a part-time basis. Also for the 6,000 fishers, they also get compensated for their work. In the beginning, we started in a volunteering scheme and it worked. But then we started experimenting with a little bit monthly funding. And it's not a lot. It's like 10 to 50 euros per month per fisherman, right? And on average, they started collecting 7 times more plastic per boat. So it made sense for us to keep it. And I find it fair to give back to these communities like that. We have been working also in East Africa, in Kenya. We are discussing now a potential expansion to Southeast Asia. But before doing that, my biggest dream is to be able to expand our work in the Nile River. According to WWF, the Nile is responsible for at least 40% of the plastic in the Mediterranean Sea. So I'm thinking of some solutions of potentially addressing the problem there. I'm optimistic that we can effectively clear up the Mediterranean Sea. And then we can use this model to clear similar seas or oceans around the world. On that front, I decide to be an optimist. When I started, you know, my whole project, I was like 21, 22 years old. People don't take you seriously. Like when you are 24 and you're talking to a CEO of a multinational company, you're younger than the interns they have over there. But age does not mean that you don't know what you're talking about. You can drive a change. You can, you know, make a real impact. Starting young, you have nothing to lose. And you're not afraid to make mistakes. So in my case, I've made mistakes all the time. And I come to realize that, you know, failure is not the opposite of success, but kind of the middle step to achieve it.
And that's it for today. This program was produced by Charlie Shields and me, Laura Kabelka. Our sound engineers were Gerd Georgi and Ziad Abu Sleiman. If you like the show and you want to make us happy, you can leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn and Berlin.